But it's hard to know who to talk about among the list of crazy friends. This started about two years ago, when I just bought some slides about varieties of artists and talked using their lives as examples of varieties of craziness, and craziness as something that you would that you could respect, that maybe you could even honor. There is something in art that seems to repel normalcy. I don't know why. I don't know why, but it's and sometimes that's a temptation to people who are getting into art to assume that if they are crazy, they might make a good artist, or if they are normal. I mean, if they are just whatever normal is, really just average and nothing ever happened to them, and they read about Van Gogh who cut off his left ear, that maybe if they cut off their left ear that some genius will bud. Or if they live in an attic and eat moldy cheese and dry bread and don't shave and smell bad and walk around barefooted and stuff, that maybe that's what artists do. I'm not here to deny that. But that's not all. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. And I look at the lives of certain artists as having maybe special importance for this community, for the family of the faithful, for special people who are interested in how the development and relationship between art and the church has existed, or just as people who are so interesting and committed to things in their own life that they serve as some viable examples for us. All kinds of reasons for seeing them, but their uniqueness stamps them as crazy. I get a little bit tired of people who analyze art based on certain aberrations. Like, I understand El Greco, who painted long, skinny people, has finally been analyzed as being myopic, that maybe his contacts went this way. He had bifocals that with lines that went up and down instead of that way. And of course, Van Gogh painted the way he did because he was crazy, you see. And that's not true. Actually, he was crazy because he painted the way he did. The painting came first, and don't you forget it. And that's important. But he was crazy like good Christians are crazy. And I already talked about how that happens. And if you want to know how that works, get the tape. We haven't got time for it tonight. Michelangelo was crazy too. I mean, Michelangelo was super weird. And when you talk that way about a fellow like Michelangelo, you are stepping on toes. Like when we talked about Rembrandt and said Rembrandt was crazy. But he was, and he did crazy paintings, funny, silly kinds of things, and he was searching for things that nobody else searches for, and that makes him unusual, and unusual is kind of crazy. Michelangelo comes to us again, sort of like Rembrandt, as an example of someone who makes things out of his condition, out of his situation, and then stamps his mark on it, but is not ahead of it. Not ahead of it. In fact, the more I think of the artist and his time or her time and their lives, I guess I think that this whole idea of artists being ahead of their time is just silly. It's just foolish. They are too busy in looking around at what's going on around them and analyzing it with their eyes and their materials and saying, this is how it sums up. So that if you want to know how the de' Medici situation was in the late 1400s, you look at Michelangelo. If you want to know what effect the Protestant Reformation had on Rome at the time Luther was doing his darndest, you look at Michelangelo. And you look at one particular piece, which we'll see in a minute, the Last Judgment. It's a scary thing. And it's Lutheran. I love to say that because it is right in back of the Pope's chair in the Sistine Chapel at the highest spot in the whole of Roman Catholicism. And then there's this great Lutheran painting back there which Michelangelo painted under the influence of some very radical Roman Catholics who were studying with Protestant theologians in Rome. And it got into his painting. And I love that. I think that's kind of nifty. Michelangelo is also an example of the fact, it's my fact, it's not a universal fact, but my fact is still a fact, that artists are not born artists. I just can't picture it. I just do not believe there are born artists any more than there are born waitri. And if anybody can convince me that somebody is a born waitri, I'll eat fish. It's a thing you gotta learn. I mean, maybe waitri is a bad example. Maybe pit person is a better one, you know, or pots and pans person. I mean, if I thought that I would be back in that pit someday and somebody had come along and say, now that guy is a born pit person, I'd just wipe my hands of this whole place and I'd probably even enjoy Valparaiso. But it's something you learn. It's something you tolerate. It's something you put up with. It's something that your influence and your environment allows to sink in. To think of Michelangelo as springing full-blown from his mother's womb with a hammer and chisel in his hand is not only a disgusting symbol, but I just don't think it's possible. It's the thought of that possibility is just absurd. That he could learn how to carve and whack around on stuff right off the bat is just not to be believed. But there are so many things in his growing up years that made a lot. Michelangelo was born into a kind of well-to-do, semi-noble family. Now, I don't know what semi-noble. Nobility, but kind of not like the mayor of Chicago, more like a precinct captain, okay? That is a man with a little authority who wields it with a very big stick. That was Michelangelo's father. And his mother was a social climber. She had soirees in the afternoon and had nobody but the best over to the house. She had long embroidered gowns, and she had a couple servants even. You know, that's not the artist's life, but that's what Michelangelo was born into. They had just inherited a duchy north of Florence. I mean, like a little place with a moat and everything and a drawbridge. And like a little castle. And Michelangelo's mom and dad were getting ready to move into this place when she notices a bulge below her belt. And she, oh, come on, not now. I mean, it's just the wrong time. We got we're going to have parties, man. We're going to, you know, we're going to have like dances, you know, and we're got, nothing is going to fit. Can you, I just went down and I got this Gucci and it's going to, a Pucci Gucci, and it's just not going to make it. We can't have the snotty little brat running around while we got all the hoi polloi over. It's not going to work. Absolutely not. And so, as soon as they move into the house and the brat is born, Mr. and Mrs. Michelangelo, that's not right. Mr. and Mrs. Richard, no. Mr. and Mrs. Buonarroti, that's why we call him Michelangelo. What a disgusting name. Mr. and Mrs. Buonarroti says, ship him off. Get him out of here. He gives no class to this place at all. And so she finds a wet nurse in a little village to the west of their little duchy. And that's almost the last that those folks ever see of little Mike. Yeah, that's it. And this wet nurse, now are you listening? The wet, are you? Okay, well it's true. The wet nurse is the wife of, now get this, a stone carver. Whoa, heavy. And he writes later on in a sonnet that I got marble dust in my mother's milk. Brick. But you get the picture? I mean, if he had stayed at home like most good kids, like I'm a born whatever I'm a born, we would not have what we got. If his mom and dad had not been such meshuggahness and schnooks and sent the little kid away and had somebody else bring him up, we would not have a Sistine ceiling, a Last Judgment, a Pietà, another Pietà, two more Pietàs. None of them good things would we have. He's a born artist. Baloney. Baloney. Circumstances allowed for it to happen. And he learned how to carve from his, what is the father of your wet nurse called? A wet father? I don't know. What would you call? A what?
LVD.
LVD? No. Okay, all right, it doesn't matter, I guess. But he learned it from him, and that's where he got all of his instruction. And he was good. Right off the bat, he was good. And so good that these folks who sort of became his foster parents wrote back to the little duchy and said, hey, this kid needs some bringing up. Can we send him to the big city? And they did. And they sent him to Florence to learn his craft. And he studied at the studio of Ghirlandaio. He also studied in an academy. And this, I just, before we turn the lights out, history is the most amazing thing. It is just incredible how it happens. And if you think it's dry, it's because you don't know good history. I mean, you don't know real history. It's like people who say Bach is boring. They just haven't heard good Bach. There was a time when you had the separation of East and Western churches, and the Eastern Church was established over in Constantinople, all right, now Istanbul, and the Western Church established in Rome. And that was way back in the 300s when that happened under Constantine. Things were hard for both sides, but there was a time when the last emperor of Byzantium came to Italy and tried to make an alliance with the Pope, and Palaeologus and the Pope met. And Palaeologus, the emperor of Byzantium, tried very hard with his retinue and his court to impress the Pope so much that he would give Byzantium some money and arms, weaponry, and soldiers to help beat off the invading tribes, the Turks primarily. And it didn't work. And the Pope said, I'm sorry, I got an army of my own, and things are kind of rough over here, but there's a little town north of here, and they got a banker up there that you wouldn't believe. He's got money, he's got influence. Go up there and see if he'll help you. And Palaeologus took his entire retinue up to Florence, and he met with the old man of the town, and he said, can you help me? And the old man said, I can't. We're just getting started here. But boy, do I love your retinue. He said that in Italian. I don't know what that was. No, he said it in Latin. I don't know what that sounded like, but what it meant was, what I'd really like to do is copy your court, because it looks interesting. You got cartographers, geographers, you got scriptographers and historians and mathematicians, and they are from all over the world. You got humanists and Greek scholars, all kinds of people. And I would like to have that in my court. Well, this guy was not a prince. This guy was just a banker by the name of de Medici. And we have in the court of the de Medicis a copy of Palaeologus' system from Constantinople. And what it eventually winds up to be is like a little school. And people, you know, like Holden in the summer, you take whatever's here. If somebody comes and they know, you know, and you know astronomy, they teach you astronomy. And if there are scholars in language, they'll teach you language. And whoever comes gets those people. And they learn with them. And so under a system established in Constantinople, Lorenzo de Medici establishes a court called the Neoplatonic School. And everything winds up to be a kind of mix, a heavy, complicated, and rather boring mix of Christianity and various mythologies. And under this school program, all of the significant artists were trained. The librarian of this brand new school was Piccolomini Mirandella, who becomes the first humanist pope. And there goes the church. A mix of mythology, philosophy, and Christianity in little dips and dabs. Okay? And into the school comes Leonardo from a little town called Vinci, Raphael, Michelangelo, Ghirlandaio, Sandro Botticelli, all more of my crazy friends. And they come into this school and get their heads filled with a little of this. Michelangelo could not handle the language. They had to learn Greek and Latin. And he failed miserably, which makes him an artist in my eyes. Because anybody who flunks language cannot be all bad. But he learned. And he learned his craft, and he learned a philosophy that later on was going to desert him, so that when the Reformation came along, he could say, there's something that I didn't get in the Neoplatonic school. And that allowed him to do that mural in the Vatican, the Last Judgment. Okay? So, all based on an oriental thing. And it designed the university for us. It eventually becomes the humanities. And that is the basis for liberal arts education. And it comes from Palaeologus, the emperor of Constantinople. You gotta love that. I think I will carry this around. One of his first pieces, 24 years old, that makes me so mad, was it the guy that was listening, Mozart play one of his things and said, he was studying piano and said, do you realize that when Mozart was my age, he had been dead for 8 years? It is a little humiliating sometimes to look at the art of the masters, if you're an artist, realize that some 24-year-old punk kid did this thing, and here you are struggling along, trying to whack out you can't even carve soap, you know. But now look what we got here already. Right off the bat, we got this influence from the Neoplatonic school. You got to recognize that. There is a variety of Christianity here which allowed them at this time to talk about even artists differently than they've ever talked about them before or since. In the Middle Ages, an artist was a slave, a hack. I mean, he had to join a guild, be in a union just to get a decent wage. When Michelangelo died, Vasari called him the divine. Michelangelo referred to himself as the divine. Well, that's okay, I guess, but it was divine in the context of Neoplatonism because their job was to apprehend the beautiful. Beauty was the approximation of divinity, and the more you could construct a divine image, a beautiful image, an ultimate image, the more you yourself imitated the actions of God the Father and took on aspects of divinity yourself. Raphael, when he died, was buried where? In Rome, in the Pantheon. In Rome, an artist. Oh, I long for those days to return. Yeah. So what is he doing here? He's trying to capture beauty, not anguish, but serenity. And how does he do that? He does it in a very artistic and peculiar way. You don't look at this as the body of a dead, 33-year-old carpenter laying in his mother's lap. I mean, if any of you people want to try this sometime, just go right ahead. Take some 33-year-old guy and just lop him over your legs sometime. Hold him up under his chest with one hand and just hold your other hand out in a reasonably religious gesture. That's tough. That is a very tough posture. And she's been holding it for quite a while. She is not feeling any pain. She is stoic. That's Greek. That is Greek philosophy now, messing around with Christianity. Do you understand? We're talking about combinations of things meeting together now. It's not just, you know, you talk about Michelangelo and you say, how real. It's not real. It's an imitation of a philosophy which is a combination of all kinds of things which in the back of my mind don't seem to fit. But Michelangelo was a product of his time. He wasn't advanced. He wasn't way out there in the forefront. He was doing what was happening in Florence at this particular time. And she, in spite of the anguish, in spite of all of the pain that she has gone through, and in spite of the weight of this hulk in her lap, it's dead poundage, folks, she is not paying any attention to it. She is totally under control. She is so cool. Nobody believed that Michelangelo could do this at the age of 24, and everybody started laughing at him, and as a result, he snuck in one night and wrote, "Michelangelo did it all right," right across the sash. I don't know if you can make it out on Mary's bosom, right across here. Can you read it? Little lettering across it. Can you imagine? Talk about realism. Mary under the cross with her dead son and a sign across her chest saying, "Michelangelo made this thing." We are talking about a specific time, a time that would allow for an ego like that. There we go. Could this guy carve? Amazing carving. Just carved absolutely like butter. Even the posture of Christ is not one of agony, it's one of relaxation. I ought to show you one other thing. Oh, man. We know as we look at this how Mary is able to keep under such control as she holds the body of her son. If she stood up, she'd be a foot and a half taller than he would. Do you see that? That is an artist's device. It's called economy of measure. And what it does is take varieties of weights and equalizes them so that they make sense together. And it makes pretty good visual sense for a woman that size to have this body wrapped around her body. She can handle that. But if he were actual size, it would be very awkward. And so Michelangelo just simply reduced the size of the body. Oh, come on, Richard. Another view from on top of the head. Of course, this is all under glass now. I think I was just talking to one of you that just was over in Rome, and boy, they're standing in front of this thing now with armed guards because some poor demented fellow went in there and started whacking around with a chisel a couple years ago, knocked off a finger and the nose of the Virgin Mary. They patched it up, and boy, you would not know. You wouldn't know that any damage had been done. On your right, David. Now, who is David? Well, Old Testament figure, okay, but David is something else. David is the city of Florence. Okay? So when you describe Florence, you describe David, and vice versa. A young, growing city that says it will take on any of the giants. It will take on Milan, it will take on Rome, it will take on Venice. Just bring them all on. Florence can handle them. And he stands there naked, ready to face the giants. And he becomes what in Germany we call a Stadtwappen, that is a city sign, a badge of honor for the city. And he was built in order to stand in the courtyard of the city, and eventually the damage was being done by all kinds of stuff, and so they moved him inside to the Academia, a museum. He's immense. He is huge, from the bottom to the top, 18 feet. And you talk about realism. You got to talk about a particular kind of realism. There is some. I'm a city boy, so I can't verify this, but somebody says when you're in Kansas on a hot summer night, you can hear the corn grow. Is that true? Or in South Dakota or whatever, you can hear things growing? Well, I It sounds reasonable. When I was a sophomore in high school, my parents could hear me grow. That's true. I would just sit in a chair doing my homework, and my folks would, you know, Dad would say, "Dorothy, did you hear that?" And she'd say, "It's okay, Rich. It's just Richard growing." I grew 13 inches that year. Look at the meat hooks on that guy. Immense things. You can't tell it from here, but his feet are like that too. I mean, they look like pontoons from a certain angle. Everything not quite in shape. It's Greek. The head is pure Greek. The hair is a copy of a Greek statue. And so it's a combination of the ideas that were relevant at this particular time. It is about Florence. The most amazing thing about this is not its reality, but its craft. How it was done. There was a gigantic block of marble behind the court, behind the city hall in Florence, and it was called the Giant. It was called the Giant because some klutz had started carving a large piece of sculpture out of it and caused a big crack to go down through the middle of it. And it was just sitting there and nobody knew what to do with it. Michelangelo, after he had done the Pieta and carved his name on it, everybody was saying, "Hey, give him the Giant. Let's see if he can handle it." And Michelangelo said, "I'll take it. I'll take it. Give me the Giant." And he carved this out of the Giant, out of a piece of marble that had a crack going through it. And everything is done in what's called contrapposto, okay? I'm going to give you certain words. You will remember them. I'll ask questions after. Not so much for the exam, which is to follow, but so that when you go into museums and stand in front of art pieces, you can use these words and people will be amazed. And this will be of value to you in later life. So remember, contrapposto. And what contrapposto means is that when you are depicting reality, you usually, in the human form, you don't do it like the Egyptians and stride straight forward like so, but you put weight on one hip, all right? And when you put weight on one hip, one leg has to come up because the legs are different lengths now. When that leg comes up, this hip is at an axis, the shoulder is at a counter axis, and they are all pivoting. They are not straight anymore. You cannot have this line through the hip and this line through the shoulder parallel to one another. They spin. If you look down on it, you would be describing an arc of axes. And that's contrapposto. That arc eventually becomes a kind of theology in Renaissance art. And it's called the golden arc. Anybody hear that? And some of you musicians may have heard of it from Fibonacci, who designed whole musical systems based on this golden mean. And that's contrapposto. And so as we have these various angles, we define a curving negative space, like a corkscrew of space going through the figure. And Michelangelo designs David on such a contrapposto that the corkscrew of space is the crack in the marble. Do you believe that? Carving and at any minute realizing that if while you are whacking away you hit that crack, what you will wind up with is enough gravel to pave a driveway. Really? The whole thing would have just turned into pebble. So that's the genius of this. You don't necessarily see it when you look at it, but the history of it really tells you. Oh, he did other Madonnas and look at, I love the baby. This one was done for a wealthy merchant in Bruges, up in Belgium. And how would you like to have that? Doesn't he look like Mussolini? The little baby? Look at that. But do you recognize Madonna? It's the same lady. Totally cool. Absolutely impervious to impending doom, to prophecies of what was going to happen to her son. She is the epitome of beauty. Everything under control. That is the epitome of beauty at this time. Oh, he does a lot of stuff for the Medicis. Oh, he does some stuff for the Pope. Pope wants him to design a huge tomb. I mean, an enormous tomb that's going to have 40 statues like that Moses statue there. And he never winds up finishing. He spent 41 years on that project, and all that's left of it are three little statues. Including the Moses, or Charlton Heston, as he is more commonly known. Florence was a really, I guess it must not have been a very comfortable place to live in. There was so much intrigue, Machiavellian shenanigans, and it makes me wonder from time to time about the relationship between art and violence. I think there's a historical link between those two, that creative binges occur at very violent times, and Florence was very violent at this time. These two boys, Medici boys, were attending mass one morning when one was murdered and one was wounded as they knelt at the altar. And Michelangelo was commissioned to do their tombs, one being an extrovert and one being an introvert. And Michelangelo designed morning, noon, and morning and evening, and dusk and dawn to cover them. And do you see? Do you get the impression of these statues, as they are on their catafalques here, that they are about to slide off? I mean, there's something very, very tenuous about that whole thing. And in the design of that fragile existence, you know, morning and evening and dusk and dawn are constantly moving. You know, they're just slipping over the horizon. But in depicting that, Michelangelo has predetermined here the Baroque. That doesn't mean he was existing in a Baroque idea. It means that the Baroque age took an awful lot of Michelangelo's ideas, especially in these instances, and use them for their own ideas about fragility of space and anguish, turmoil, and tension. One of his last pieces was this Descent from the Cross. I'm showing you his sculpture first because he was essentially a sculptor. He said painting was women's work, which will really make him crazy in our eyes when we see what he did then. This was one of the last. It's the Descent from the Cross, and behind is Nicodemus, and it's a self-portrait of Michelangelo. So here Michelangelo is, a detail of that, as we see him in his later years. So, the Pope says, Michelangelo, let's do a painting, and Michelangelo says, painting is woman's work. I'm not a painter, I'm a sculptor. The Pope had a cousin, though, who was second sculptor to Michelangelo. Mike got all the good stuff, and this other guy got all the second-rate commissions. And so he went to his uncle, the Pope, and said, if you put Michelangelo up on a scaffold for 4 years, maybe I'll get some better commissions. Michelangelo knew that. And he knew that he had never done a fresco in his life, and fresco is an incredibly technical media. This is not, what's on top of you right now is not a fresco. That's a painting on a ceiling. This is not a painting on a ceiling. This is a painting in a ceiling. You have to plaster as you go along. And you don't paint into the plaster. You pound paint up into the plaster. Okay? Now, Michelangelo had never done this. He got four guys up on the scaffold with him, and within a month he got mad at every one of them. Three of them fled, and the fourth one he kicked off the scaffold down to the floor below, where he broke his neck and died, and they had to reconsecrate the whole chapel before they could use it again. And it became a one-man deal. Just one guy. Now let's get rid of the first myth about this. He did not lay on his back for 4 years. There is no way that a person can paint while they're on their back. And you just, you know, just try and picture how that would be. Where would he put the paint? On his tummy? Can you imagine? And the top step would have to be an arm's length from the ceiling. That's, you know, on your back, that far from the ceiling. Now that's ridiculous. Absolutely. And not only that, but you can't see where you're going. You can only see about, 3 foot by 3 foot square if you're on your back. No, he stood up. He was to write from on top of this scaffold, I've grown a goiter from dwelling in this den as cats long down in Lombardy. You know how cats, when they walk, have those shoulders that stick up when they run? Michelangelo, after 3 years of holding his arm over his head as he painted, became permanently humpback and went around with a great growth sticking out of his back for the rest of his days. He was a very homely man to look at. He was homely to begin with, but after this, it was Katie barred the door. It was scared everybody. You got to know that feeling. You just got to know that feeling, because Michelangelo, in this particular project, stands as an incredible example of will. He gets up there knowing that he is being had. I mean, it's a plot to get him out of the way. It is, in addition, a plot to have him made a fool of, because he's never painted before, and we have got to bring Michelangelo down, so said the competitors. And he himself hated the business of painting. And yet the Pope said so. The Pope went to Florence and dragged him out of Florence and said, I will kick you out of the church if you don't get up there. And so he did. And he was up there for 4 years. If you want some kind of an idea of the size, this width, approximately, and 2.5 times longer, and 3 times higher up. Okay? Does that help tell you how big we are? We are plastering a 2 foot by 2 foot square, painting into the plaster as we go, pounding the pigment into the plaster, standing up, resting our head against our arm, and just beating the ceiling. Now, some of you that were here in the winter when I painted this and would be up there for a couple days will probably remember that a couple times I came down from the scaffold and it took me a half a day to get my arm off the top of my head. I just couldn't bring it down. Around 10 o'clock, I'd have the arm on my shoulder like this. And getting around lunchtime, I'd have my arm. People thought I was a cocky sucker. I was just walking around with my hand on my waist all the time. I just couldn't get my arm down. It was embedded. And that was for 3 months. This was for 4 years. Okay? The cycle was intended to make the chapel iconographically, that is, with images, include everything. You name it, it's in there. The whole world. The best way to describe the chapel would be a Te Deum. The Old Testament is in there. The New Testament, the creation is in there. When the ceiling was done, there was only one thing that had not been included. The future. So 20 years after Michelangelo finished the ceiling, the Pope says, come on in and do the back wall with the future on it. Okay? So, let's look at a couple details of the ceiling. It's the creation motif. And it's divided into these little units. The ceiling is not a good ceiling to paint. It's not like this one. This is a beautiful ceiling to paint. It's just one all one piece. But this ceiling was a bunch of little intersecting vault systems. And so there were lumps and waves as it went down. And he had to organize all of those little pieces. Now we could spend a couple years. This is a 9-credit course in Indiana University, and I'm, you know, not about to let you off with no tuition. But if you want to get an idea, he started painting down at that end and gradually worked his way this way. And his style changed so that if you looked, and here it's in reverse. So here he would have started painting at this end and worked his way down that way. And he worked his way chronologically in reverse. The first painting would be the separation of the firmament, and that was the last painting that he did. And the creation of light, and the days of creation, and then the creation of man, and so forth and so on. But he started his painting with the flood and the drunkenness of Noah, which is here. And here's the flood section, and you can see there are just scads of painting, just people all over the place. But as he goes down to here and through the fall, the creation of woman, the creation of light, and so forth, things get simpler and simpler and simpler, so that at the very end of the creation of the ceiling, of the painting of the ceiling, everything is done in very broad, broad strokes. Now see, that's the beginning. Those are details from the flood. And they're really heavily peopled. Michelangelo was a sculptor. He was a sculptor even when he was a painter. And this style is what we call the sculpturesque mode of projection. I'm not going to bore you with it, but to tell you that whenever you look at a fresco of Michelangelo's, look for heavy lines around his figures. You staff people that were taking drawing classes, started our drawing classes today, you'll know that that's a way of abstracting with those heavy lines around there, and that's really important. It means that Michelangelo is working from the wall forward, and that makes him a sculptor, not a realistic painter. There are no lines around realistic things. And there is the creation of woman over here and the fall. I don't think I want to get into Michelangelo's difficulty with women, or men for that matter, nor do I want to describe the rather chauvinistic theology that Michelangelo was really forced to depict. If you'll note, the serpent wrapped around the tree winds up being a woman.
Huh?
Well, we better change the slide quick. Now, there's the creation of man, and I've got two slides to show you a slight difference in them. The one on the right is though you were looking at it flat. The one on the left is as though Michelangelo were looking at it. Because, as you know, everything was on the curve, so he saw everything in a strange distortion. And that's kind of important, to know that we have to be able to see it straight, but he had to paint it on that curved angle. So it was in, you know, tremendously complicated to paint. And God comes out, and if you have an image in your mind of God the Father, this is probably it. A great old grandfather top sergeant in the sky, pointing his finger, waving, coming hither and yon, forward and backwards. He creates, Michelangelo was, I love this, he was not good at shrubbery. Me, I'm not good at feet. Whenever I do people, I do them with long robes, so I don't have to do feet. Michelangelo was very good with feet, but he had trouble with shrubbery. So with the creation of vegetation, he just turns his back on the whole thing, goes away, and leaves a little bush down in the lower left-hand corner. I mean, what kind of vegetation is that? And it was just Michelangelo hated the whole idea of painting vegetation. He was a people painter. Now, as you can see on the right, that's the last image from that particular series, the first day of creation. And it's very loose and free-flowing compared to the flood painting. This is after 4 years. In addition to that, Michelangelo painted in various lunettes pictures of prophets and sibyls who are lady prophets, prophetesses. And these sibyls are some of the most potent female images we have in the whole history of art. Some of them look like Russian discus throwers. There's one, I think it's the Cumaean sibyl. It's really neat, because the prophet Zacharias, for example, is a very learned guy, but he's a very typical prophet person. But that lady really seems to be much more embedded in the words than Zacharias is. These women are marvelous. Some of them are behemoths, and the men just seem to be rather normal. There's a woman on the left who's probably the best looking of all of the sibyls. I think she's the Delphic oracle, and that's Jeremiah on the right. But look at her. Oof, Danita! How'd you like to run into her on the corners? Holy mackerel, Andy! She's got an arm that's bigger than my leg. She could snap me like a pretzel. I don't know what she's reading about in the future, but I'm glad I'm not there. She is mad. Oh! How'd you like to have her meet you at the bus down there and give you a big hold and hug? Woofta. What a great lady. The Cumaean sibyl. She's got more personality than the prophets did. I don't know. I like. And boy, could Michelangelo paint feet. Look at those feet. She'd be great in the grape business. Michelangelo did architecture as well. He did tremendous pieces of architecture. And some of them are very complicated. This is a design for a chapel outside of where the Medici tombs are. And this is the entrance to the Laurentian Library, that university that Lorenzo de' Medici established. That's the library up there. But Michelangelo designed it so that it's a scary thing to walk up. It's like walking into the surf. He's got all these great waves of stuff coming out at you, and it's almost like you struggle to walk up those steps because of some kind of anti-gravity system he's got in there. Michelangelo was also in charge of doing St. Peter's. By the time he got the commission to finish St. Peter's, which he never did finish, he was 80 years old. 80. When he started the ceiling, the Sistine ceiling, he was 34. All right, and he spent 4 years on that. 20 years later, I'm sorry, 40 years later, he was doing this particular project, and in between, starting at about 64 years old, he was told to do the Last Judgment painting. So he was just bouncing from one commission to the other. The only thing really that we have of Michelangelo's on St. Peter's is this particular thing, the dome, which is a masterpiece and would have looked really neat the way Michelangelo had designed the cathedral. He designed it as a Greek cross, four equal arms with a dome in the center. And we could have seen it. The dome would have shown beautifully. But after he died, they wanted the thing more like a basilica, and they brought the front out, and they put something across the front that looks very much like the First National Bank in Chicago. It's really a Haislake-looking facade. And of course, the dome sits way back now, and you can barely make it out, but it is an incredible piece of work. It's very, very dynamic. Beautiful thing. Well, the Last Judgment painting, and unfortunately my slides aren't any good of it, the Last Judgment is probably his most important work as far as we're concerned. It shows a Christ which is actually an Apollo, a Greek Apollo, and he is waving and flailing his arms in such a fury that his mother is now no longer the mother of the Pietà. She is no longer a cool lady. She is cowering at the judgment that her son is wreaking on everybody. There is no longer a nice, even division between the damned and the saved. You always, in medieval art, had good guys looking one way and bad guys looking another way. In Michelangelo's Last Judgment, they are all mixed up together. And the souls are coming up through the ground, and bodies are being dragged down. One guy is sitting on a stump, looking through his hands, like all you see is his big eyes, and there's a devil pulling him down. I have a huge poster of that thing, which I had made. I call it Final Exams. And the students know exactly what I mean. The other probably enjoyable feature is that the assistant, the secretary to the Pope, always kept coming in, you know, once a week and saying, "Is it done yet? Is it done yet?" And he got so angry, just Michelangelo just got so furious at this guy that he painted his picture in hell, down in the lower left-hand corner, and Satan is beating him with a paddle, just rolling the tar out of him, and this guy walks, well, can you imagine that? He walks in there one day, and he says, "Hey, is it done yet?" "Hey!" And he runs to the Pope, and he says, "Your Grace, Michelangelo just put me in hell, and if there's anybody that can get me out of there, I demand that you go in there, Your Eminence, and have him erase my face off of that." And the Pope said, "I'm sorry, my son." You know the way popes talk. And he said, "If he had put you in purgatory, there might have been something I could have done." So it's still in there. And it is a painting of disaster. Because between the ceiling and the Last Judgment came the sack of Rome and the Reformation and Michelangelo's disenchantment with all the Neoplatonic versions of Christianity that he had grown up with. It was not enough. And so he said, "God is coming and we are all together in this thing. Protestant, Catholic, the whole geschmush is in judgment right now. And if things don't shape up, everything is going to wind up on the bottom level. It is all dropping out of the sky and heading straight for hell. There is almost no redeeming grace in his last judgment painting. It's a frightening thing. The next thing, of course, was the Counter-Reformation, of which Michelangelo had little to contribute. But we see a man torn between his time, what he knew and what he thought was right, and a man with incredible, incredible ability who seemed to be driven not so much by technique as by faith, which is probably the thing that ought to drive us all. Good night.